Good morning and welcome to Beyond the Pale, the Progressive Jewish Radio Hour here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. I'm Esther Kaplan.
I'm Marilyn Kleinberg-Niemark.
We're back in the saddle with Marilyn this week, and we have, I think, what promises to be an extremely interesting program today. We're going to be speaking with Chip Berlay, an expert on the right wing, about a book by Jim Marrs, Rule by Secrecy, which has been discussed at length over these airways, especially by Marjorie Moore and her new program, Marjorie in the Morning. The Jim Marrs book was used as a premium during this past May's fundraising marathon, and he's been a guest on Marjorie's show three separate times, and his conspiracy theory, which certainly does, yes, extend to Jewish bankers, has been the subject of a lot of consternation by our listeners. We've been hearing a lot by phone and email that people need to get a really strong critique of this work. He quotes at length from the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, so we're going to be looking at that notorious anti-Semitic tract too. So please stay tuned. We'll be taking your calls. But first,
a few weeks back, maybe more than that, I interviewed Joan Shankar, the author of Truly Wild, the unsettling story of Dolly Wild, Oscar's unusual niece, published by Basic Books. And we were waiting for a rainy Sunday to air it, and we finally have our rainy Sunday. So we're going to begin with that interview with Joan Shankar, and then we'll be talking with Chip Berlay about conspiracies now and then.
So we first wanted to just maybe say a few words about someone that was lost to us in the progressive Jewish world.
Indeed. We got an email this week from JFRIDGE member Marian Feinberg with the sad news that Israel Shahak, one of her heroes, and one of Esther's and mine, too, has died. Shahak died on July 6th at the age of 68 from complications caused by diabetes. A survivor of the Holocaust, Israel Shahak was a hero for a generation of Middle East activists who in the 70s and 80s depended on his translations of articles from the mainstream Israeli press, accompanied by his scathing commentaries. Shahak railed against torture in Israel, collective punishment in the West Bank and Gaza, the building of settlements, and the rampages of settlers. When illness finally forced him to cease publication close to a decade ago, he left a gap that it took some years and the internet to fill. And even then, those of us whose activism was nurtured by the Shahak papers missed his unique, angry, and intelligent voice. How desperately we need him now.
Well, may he rest in peace, and may the rest of us pick up where he left off. So we're going to begin the show today with that interview about Dolly Wild, Oscar Wilde's niece. So stay with us. Real one does not seem to want to go. Marilyn, you want to try to... Interesting. Are we having a little trouble with that? All right, well, let's give it a minute. Let's see if we can string that reel up right. I think what I'll do is give us a little bit of music, and when we get that reel going, we'll go straight to it.
Talking with Joan Shankar, who's been called America's most original female contemporary playwright, whose works are produced, taught, read and reviewed across North America and Western Europe. She's the recipient of 40 grants, honors, and awards, has had more than 400 productions throughout the world, and has been a guest artist in many venues in North America. Her collection of plays, Signs of Life, Six Comedies of Menace, is a Wesleyan University Press bestseller. And today she's here to talk about Truly Wild, the unsettling story of Dolly Wild, Oscar's unusual niece, which is being published by Basic Books. Welcome, Joan, to Beyond the Pale.
Thank you.
Well, let's begin with, who is Dolly Wild?
Well, that's a question many people are asking. For 60 years, she was a delicious rumor. Oscar Wilde's unusual niece, who looked like him, loved like him, had the same kind of celebrity that he had in the salons of London and Paris. And then, in 1941, with her death at the same age as Oscar and of the same addictions, simply disappeared from the face of the universe, like so many interesting women of that period between the wars.
Perhaps you could read a passage from the book, Truly Wild, that I thought gives a really good sense of who Dolly Wild was and sort of the complexity and contradictions of her.
Oh, I'd be pleased to. Let me just preface a reading by a little bit of a setup. Dolly was the daughter of Oscar's older and far cruder brother, Willie, and an Irish woman named Lily. Oscar Wilde paid for her birth. Willie was too drunk and too broke to come up with the money for Lily's lying in. So from his prison cell, Dolly was born 3 months into Oscar's imprisonment for gross indecency. From his prison cell, he sent £50 for Dolly's birth and became a kind of psychological father to her. They never met, but that act of paying for her birth, in a way, rebirthed her. And from that moment on, she began to imitate, unconsciously and genetically, everything Oscar did. And everyone who knew them both thought that Dolly was his reincarnation. So I'll read a little bit from this chapter called Behaving in Public, which describes Dolly's many transits across many oceans and countries, making wonderful cameo appearances, one wing dusted with epigrams, the other powdered with cocaine. Here we go. Glimpses of the public life Dolly lived between the wars look like clips from a feature film whose plot line has been accidentally deleted. The logic of her narrative, the chronology of her story, is almost always missing. But there Dolly is, dancing till dawn at Lady Carnarvon's ball in London, or floating down the Seine in a luxurious houseboat, or driving in a diplomat's touring car to Tangier, or playing tennis at a great country house in Poland, delightfully displaying a loose confederation of her several selves, as though posing for a series of postcard vignettes, each one of which seems to lack a motive for her movement. Dolly's social maneuvers spread out like talk at a marvelous party. They are everywhere at once and nowhere for very long. All of a sudden, she's telling a story about a country dance in the south of France, to which she's been taken by French friends. The tiny mayor of the town, whose head barely comes up to Dolly's shoulders, has asked her to waltz. The second time around the floor, breathing heavily, his head drooping sideways onto her breast, in a trance of desire, the little fellow whispers hotly up at her, "Mademoiselle, vous êtes la volupté même." Mademoiselle, you're the essence of sensual pleasure. "I can see what the little man meant," said Dolly's friend, the novelist Rosamund Harcourt Smith. She was like a panther. Softness, grace, purrs, and of course claws. Her huge eyes were like grapes in a greenhouse before the blue bloom gets rubbed off. When she was pleased, they had a velvety luster. When angry, her pupils retracted with the fascinating speed of a parrot's, and the blue grapes became splintered glass. And here's Dolly again, back at the Hotel Ritz bar in Paris, succinctly summing up a stuffed bird on someone's hat It looks like a seagull with a parrot's behind, in a single sufficient sobriquet. It must be a bird of paradox. Or she's in gold lamé scarves in London just after the First War, liberated from her ambulance driver's uniform and posing languidly for a society photographer. 10 years later, she's taking tea in London, trading remarks with an improbable trio of literary figures, Ezra Pound, Una Lady Trubridge, and Radcliffe Hall. Or she's back in Paris, where Nancy's cousin Victor Cunard has just seen her with her brand new drug supplier. Naturally, he's a surrealist writer, at a dinner party on the Quai des Conquilles. She has never looked so radiant, and her eyes, enhanced by the drug, are of a dazzling blue. And still in Paris, Dolly is spending wild nights out on the town with Scott and Zelda Fitzgerald. Her coal-rimmed eyes and total lack of discretion impress Scott so much that he includes her in a canceled episode of Tender is the Night.
That was Dolly Wilde, and that's just an example of really the stunning prose of Joan Shenkar in describing this remarkable woman who was a very central figure. In fact, she was one of Natalie Barney's lovers, a very central figure in Natalie Barney's salon of the 20s and 30s and until her death, I suppose. So perhaps you can tell us a bit about this salon. You describe its role in the development of modernism.
Yeah. A little bit should be said first about Natalie Clifford Barney, who was like the heroine of a Henry James novel, except she was homosexual, so she had connections that Henry himself never dared to describe. When Natalie was 6 years old, she was pursued down a long hotel hall by some rich little boys throwing preserved cherries at her long blonde curls. Directly in front of her was a very tall young man whose hair was longer than hers. He picked her up in his arms, shook his cane at the young ruffians, dispersed them, sat Natalie down in his lap and told her a wonderful story. That young man was the 27-year-old Oscar Wilde on his first successful lecture tour in America. From that moment on, Natalie was possessed by Oscar. When she was 11 years old, she insisted that she be painted as Oscar's happy prince. When Oscar was in prison, she wrote him in jail. When she went on to establish her formidable 60-year-long salon in Paris, she honored him by serving every Friday the cucumber sandwiches for which he was famous. She became improbably engaged to Oscar's lover, Alfred Douglas, when he was fortune hunting in New York, and had a long affair with Alfred's unhappy fiancée, Olive Custance. And in 1927, Natalie Clifford Barney, in her early 50s, fell in love with Oscar's irresistible niece, Dorothy Wilde, in Paris. They were lovers, and their affair endured in one form or another for the next, and what turned out to be the last, 14 years of Dolly's life. And Dolly became the star turn in Natalie's salon. Because Dolly was so linguistically gifted, she had her uncle's gifts of wit, but not his ambition for the wider world, she was perfectly content to dazzle all the famous writers in Natalie's salon. And of course, all the modernist males came to Natalie's salon, and she launched all the female writers whose work constituted a subversion of the modernist movement. Mina Loy, Gertrude Stein, Juna Barnes, Nancy Cunard, Lily de Clermont, the Duchess of Clermont-Tonnerre, the painter Romaine Brooks, also Natalie's principal partner. And Dolly was absolutely in the center of that very interesting ménage, a diesel or deuce. I should include Janet Flanner, who not only was part of that salon, but also was a lover of Dolly. So this salon, though it invited all of literary Paris, at its heart was a secret, a kind of secret garden of talented, incredibly attractive, and seductive women who formed their own society in the midst of the Faubourg Saint-Germain. Nathalie Solon was famously for 60 years at 20 Rue Jacob. And that salon had everything that a society had. It had an economic, it had a sexual life, it had a spiritual life. Juno Barnes notoriously parodied it and elevated it in her book, The Lady's Almanac, in 1928, making Nathalie the centerpiece, and Dolly's in that book, as is Mina Loy and Janet Flanner. So this, nothing like Nathalie Barney's salon ever existed before, because salon, though current in Europe still, never existed for women. They were always made for intelligent women, by intelligent women, for brilliant men. Barney was the first one to really welcome women into her salon, and she did it every Friday between the hours of 5 and 8 for 60 years.
One of the things that has always struck me in reading some of the more autobiographical works, say of Gertrude Stein, in this period...
All her works are autobiographical.
But in this period from the 20s and 30s, is when I think of this period, of course, I think of Weimar Germany. I think of the looming clouds of fascism. I think of the Nazis and Mussolini and so on and so forth. And certainly in Gertrude Stein's works, one has no sense that this exists. It's as if they're living in some hermetically sealed capsule that's outside of time and space.
Well, welcome to the wide world of women writers who were interested in aesthetics and not in politics. Some of the great mistakes people have made in writing about this era is to look at the era through the eyes of the present day. In order to really understand what's going on here, you have to enter the condition of these people as an actor would enter the condition of a character. And what we all need to remember is every one of these women, with the possible exception of Lili de Clermont-Tonnerre and Mina Loy, who had made some political statements, were the daughters of Walter Pater and Sappho. They wanted to burn with a hard gem-like flame, as Pater told everyone to do, and like Sappho, they wanted to raise high the roof beam. Remember that Sappho's poems were first discovered in the 1890s, bound up in pottery crocks, and their diffusion, mostly by semi-pornographers like Pierre Louis, who wrote a book, an invented book called The Songs of Bilitis, diffused the idea of lesbian poetry, and suddenly people like Nathalie Barney, for instance, actually made a trip to Lesbos with a lover of hers, was going to set up a colony of women artists there. That's the kind of romanticism they went for. Dolly herself never had a political thought. She was perfectly capable of describing, looking at Mussolini after the wars of, after he invaded Abyssinia, not 10 yards from him, describing with, because she was a brilliant describer, perfect fidelity his head without worrying what was in it. They were devoted to aesthetics, and let us not castigate them for that. They did a wonderful job at what they did. People like Mina Loy, who had affairs with futurists and therefore knew just how hollow the male politics were of that period, certainly had some interesting things to say. And Mina famously said that people of future generations will look at our social institutions and roar with laughter. Nathalie Barney herself was a firm pacifist when no one else was, and she remained a pacifist all her life. She loathed discord, so in that sense she was political. She was, in many ways, an extraordinary feminist, and certainly set up the most aesthetically supportive institution for women of the last century. There is no one who supported more women artists than Nathalie Barney. There is simply no comparison.
Now, Nathalie Barney had, I guess it was a grandfather who was Jewish, and during the war she...
Samuel Pike.
Right. She fled to Florence to live throughout the war years in, mm-hmm. in I guess, where she was not so well known and therefore not so exposed to danger. But she also wrote an essay that was not published, but which I've never read the essay, I assume you have, which deals with Jews and...
That's right. I don't have permission to quote from that essay, so I will not do so. Natalie, unlike many have, she was in fact a quarter Jewish. Her mother, who was wonderfully creative woman and from whom Natalie inherited much of her expansive spirit. Her mother was a painter and a society hostess who had many affairs and started taking Natalie to Europe early on, married to a famously conservative railroad heir. Natalie, unlike many quarter Jews or half Jews of her era, actually tried to explore what it means to be Jewish. And like many people who had Jewish blood of that era, she accepted the sort of the racial stereotypes, and she goes through every one of them. The, you know, what does it mean to be mean with your money? What does it mean to do all this stuff? But it was actually that essay, I think, was an attempt to explore what kind of Jew she was. It was a huge question in the 20th century and in the 19th century, certainly sparked by the famous Dreyfus trial. In France, salonniers, the people who conducted salons, were asking each other, and what are you doing with your Jews? During, because, of course, Jews think of Proust. What would we know about the salons of Paris without Proust? But he was one of those Jews, one of those perhaps anti-Semitic Jews that people were asking him, what are you doing with Proust? So it was always a mixed manner. Mina Loy, also half Jewish and rather anti-Semitic herself. When Natalie Barney once wrote Gertrude Stein inviting her to the salon, she said, now, I want you to be part of the Anglo-Saxon contingent. You know, that's how they thought of each other, you see. So it's, you have to be very careful not to look at these things in the terms that we use. They're inapplicable. You really have to enter the condition of those people and see through their eyes. And it was my great pleasure to do so. I want to just tell you a quick little story about how I did so. Because Dolly, of course, who, like her uncle Oscar, was almost entirely without prejudices, except for, you know, aesthetic ones. She was very snobbish about bad writing. Said trying to read Radcliffe Hall's Well of Loneliness was like trying to walk through a plowed field. She just couldn't finish it. Dolly's stepfather, Alexander Teixeira de Matos, a very well-known translator, was a Dutch Jew who had fervently converted to Catholicism. Many Jews converted in London and were the most fervent Catholics around. She was certainly exposed to all that and had, in fact, had a rather notorious affair with one of the great actresses of the 20th century, Alla Nazimova, this magnificent Russian Jew who came over in a Russian troupe to the United States in the early part of the century, just made an extraordinary splash in Yiddish theater, stayed, didn't go back, and ended up being the highest paid actor in Hollywood. For a brief period, she sunk all her money, and I mean every bit of her money, and this is another of the terrible crosses of Dolly's life, into filming in 1922 a version of Oscar Wilde's Salome, with several of the court ladies played by men in drag and starring herself as Salome. When she met Dolly in the mid-20s, they had a brief affair, and I'm sure, like Natalie Barney, she was seeing Dolly through the eyes of Oscar.
Perhaps we can close with the, I guess, memory book. Is that the right way to describe Oscaria?
It was a kind of memory book. The book that Natalie Clifford Barney published in 1951, 10 years after Dolly's death. Natalie was stricken to the heart by Dolly's death, as was everyone who knew her. She made such an extraordinary impression. She was so charming, so seductive, so linguistically talented, and so finally unexpressed, since she could put nothing on paper but these charming letters and some stories which are now lost. That in 51, Natalie collected 12 of Dolly's friends, six of them English and American, six of them French, and had them write memorial essays for this book. And in it, she included samples from Dolly's gorgeous letters, which I am able to quote a great deal more from in this book. And that book made it possible for me to start tracing the friends of Dolly's. And so I ended up being, in a very real way, the last witness of the Salon of Natalie Barney. I met, by a glorious concatenation of circumstances, the housekeeper, Berthe Clairaut, who was Natalie Barney's housekeeper for 40 years and who kept all the records of the Salon, and I inherited them from Berthe, as I inherited all the photographs, most of them unpublished in this book. And so I had the feeling that, though I'm a playwright, I had to do this work. I was chosen people, and chosen people have no choice, as we all know. So along with this memory book called Oscaria, because that was what they called Dolly, I had to add my voice to it. And I do a chapter on Oscaria, analyzing it and showing you the different facets of Dolly that it presents. But you're left, I was left with exactly what Dolly's friends were left with. Terrible regret for her longing and the real desire that I could go on conversing with her.
I urge all of you to get a copy of Truly Wild, The Unsettling Story of Dolly Wilde, Oscar's Unusual Niece, by Joan Shankar, which is out from Basic Books. And Joan, I want to thank you for joining us here on Beyond the Pale.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Welcome back to Beyond the Pale, the Progressive Jewish Radio Hour, here on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. I'm Marilyn Kleinberg-Niemark.
And I'm Esther Kaplan.
And up next, we're going to examine conspiracy theories, particularly the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, and also in the context of a book that was discussed by Marjorie Moore on her show quite extensively, Ruled by Secrecy by Jim Mars. And we got a lot of concerned emails and calls about both what people saw as an uncritical discussion of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, and also of the conspiracy theories laid out by Jim Mars. And so we thought this was a good time to address both.
So we are very happy to be joined today by Chip Berlay, who's a senior analyst with Political Research Associates. He has been studying the right wing for 30 years. He's written for publications such as Covert Action, Mother Jones, The Progressive, and is most recently the co-author of a book that came out this past November from Guilford, Right Wing Populism in America. Welcome, Chip.
Hello, thank you.
So, Chip, the core of the argument in Ruled by Secrecy by Jim Mars is that there's a conspiracy of elites that dominate the world. Where does this idea come from?
Well, the subtitle actually explains a little bit of that. The subtitle of Ruled by Secrecy by Jim Mars is The Hidden History That Connects the Trilateral Commission, the Freemasons, and the Great Pyramids. And that in fact, is a conspiracy theory that goes back to the late 1700s. And that's the dilemma here. In other words, as progressives, we want to have a critique of elite power, but we want to make sure that it's an accurate critique. And what this particular critique is rooted in, actually, a campaign against the Enlightenment that began in the 1790s by basically right-wing forces that wanted to support church-state linkages and basically wanted to oppose revolutionary movements in Europe. And the basic contention that emerged in the late 1700s was that the Freemasons were being manipulated by a secretive group called the Illuminati. And the Freemasons exist, and so did a study circle called the Illuminati, run by a guy named Wythoff, And the theory was that the Freemasons were being manipulated by the Illuminati to spread revolution throughout the world and destroy the church and destroy the natural right of monarchies and oligarchs to run things. So that's where this is where this theory starts in the late 1790s. Within 100 years, through a variety of mechanisms, it's woven into an idea that Jewish bankers run the world, essentially, and that's obviously an anti-Semitic idea. And what happens is that the Russian secret police, essentially, take a series of actually satires and kind of polemics and weave from Europe and weave them together into a hoax document, a document that purports to be a secret set of minutes from the Jewish council that runs everything, that controls the world, which they claim is called the Learned Elders of Zion. And so the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion is a document that was created by the Russian secret police to lead pogroms against Jews at the turn of the century, essentially. And what happens then is that this document escapes from this particular usage and is publicized in Britain originally, in terms of English-speaking awareness of it, as an attempt to spread anti-Semitism in Britain. And the theory, essentially, is that, okay, they buy into this idea that the Freemasons and the Illuminati are trying to take over the world, but what they say is behind the Illuminati are Jews, this rabbinical council, this secret group. And the allegations that were made against the Freemasons are now made against the Jews. And that they run the media, they own the banks, they control the government, they basically control the universities and are brainwashing our children and all of these allegations.
And, of course, it also plays a very major role in Germany in the period just after World War One and the period of the rise of Nazism.
Well, interestingly enough, the protocols first come to the U.S. and are publicized by Henry Ford through a newspaper that he controls, and the Dearborn Independent. And what happens is that because of Ford's great wealth, he starts to circulate numbers of copies of the protocols and a whole study on what he calls the international Jewish problem. And this English language set of allegations against Jews as the, you know, nomadic and basically traitorous group that's rootless, is picked up by the theoreticians around Hitler. And, in fact, Hitler credits Henry Ford for his great work in this regard of exposing the Jewish plot. And this is incorporated into, basically, Hitler's idea of the great Jewish conspiracy theory.
So when we were speaking a little bit before you went on the air, you were talking about the dangers of this kind of analysis being adopted by the left. And how have these ideas been used over the years to against the left and against revolutionary movements of various sorts?
Well, the basic theme, of course, of all of this has been to be against the left and against the Enlightenment theories of liberty, equality, and fraternity, against any kind of movement towards global cooperation or any movement towards equality. And it basically instead, and you know, anti-Semitism has been called the socialism of fools because it's a critique of elites that socialists and progressives and liberals should have. But what it is it's a critique that's based on this conspiracist idea. So it misdirects attention away from the people who actually exercise power in America. You know, if there's a banking conspiracy in America, it's certainly not a Jewish banking conspiracy. And I don't think there is a banking conspiracy, because if you think that there's a difference between productive industrial capital and parasitic financial capital, well, that was the theory of Henry Ford and Hitler and the fascists. The idea that there's some way you can split productive industrial capital away from this parasitic and usually Jewish banking financial capital is simply ridiculous. And it has been used traditionally by fascist movements to get leftists to join them. So that's a real danger right there. The other danger, of course, is that instead of then focusing on systems and institutions of power, it attracts people on the left towards an analysis that's very individualized, and instead of seeing you know, larger social structures and a legitimate critique, say, of the Federal Reserve as being in the interest of people with wealth in general, it tries to say either that there's a secret banking elite or usually in the far right that there's a secret Jewish banking elite. And so instead of organizing for greater equality and economic justice, people start trying to run around and find where these, you know, 12 guys drinking bourbon in the basement in Wall Street are hidden.
I want to mention, Chip, to our listeners, a book that some of them may find very interesting that's recently been reissued. It was published originally, I think, in 1967, went out of print, and has come back into print. It's by Norman Cohen, who is C-O-H-N, who is a British historian. And this book is called Warrant for Genocide, The Myth of the Jewish World Conspiracy and the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. And it gives a lot of the details of the various sources from which elements of the protocols are taken, which it's quite an amazing read. And he, for example, he talks about there's something in the protocols, often appended in the included in the protocols, called the Rabbi Speech, which comes from a novel written in 1864. And there are other elements of it which come from a satire, a dialogue between Montesquieu and Machiavelli, which was an attempt to develop a critique of Napoleon III that was published in France in 1864. And these are woven into the final document, the protocols. And of course, there were many different versions of the protocols and many different explanations of how they were discovered and where they were found and so on. But for that kind of detail, this Warrant for Genocide is quite an interesting source.
Well, it's a classic work in the field, and there's a number of others that reach similar conclusions. There's no doubt that the protocols is a hoax, that it's a plagiarized document. It was just stolen wholesale, as you say, from a number of earlier works. But more interestingly to me is that it really restates the theories put forward in the earlier Freemason Illuminati conspiracy theories of the late 1790s. And what it does is it simply says, well, you know, same allegations, except instead of targeting the Illuminati behind the Freemasons, it targets Jews. So it introduces the element of anti-Semitism into what is a right-wing critique of power that's conspiracist. And the distinction here is that I don't think Jim Mars thinks of himself as an anti-Semite. And indeed, his material, and I've read Rule by Secrecy, I've read at least 100 books just like it, it's hardly new. He basically mimics the theories of the John Birch Society, which is an ultra-conservative group that believes in a vast conspiracy of secret elites. Now, like the Birch Society, Mars is quick to say that he's not an anti-Semite, far be it, he claims. But then he simply restates many of the same themes that originate in this historical conspiracist theory. So it's important to understand the difference between a group such as the neo-Nazis in United Christian Identity, Aryan Nations, groups like that, which say they're openly anti-Semitic and proclaim that the protocols are true, and groups like the Birch Society, which is closer to Jim Mars, who take this historic anti-Freemason, anti-Jewish conspiracy theory and then try and sanitize it of its anti-Semitic roots. And I think that they're sincere in that effort, but they, of course, fail. You can't take the anti-Jewish elements out of this historic conspiracy theory because they're embedded in it at this point. So no matter how hard somebody tries to say, look, you know, some of my best friends are Jews, I'm not an anti-Semite, but we know that the Trilateral Commission and the Council on Foreign Relations and the Federal Reserve and the Bilderbergers and the Freemasons, and it all tracks back to this conspiracy that begins with the Great Pyramids, as Jim Mars does. And then you start to pick at that, and that theory is a phony theory, and it again, it's an individualized view promoted by right-wing groups for the last 200 years. But then you start scratching it, and you discover, of course, that there's an overemphasis of the role of Jewish banking families like the Rothschilds in a lot of this work. And to me,
including in Jim Mars' work, I mean, the Rothschilds show up in a million different guises. They seem to have started the Civil War in the United
right.
States. They seem to have funded Hitler. They seem to even
right.
have been related to Hitler. They seem to have been controlling J.P. Morgan. I mean, they're everywhere.
Everywhere, and that's the distinction. I mean, you can write a serious look at the very important role the Rothschilds played in Europe in developing, you know, modern banking. But if they're everywhere, it's the difference between looking at a powerful family like the Rockefellers and saying, you know, they had a lot of power. It's true. So did the Rothschilds at a certain point. But if you then extend that into this vast conspiracy, that's when it becomes anti-Semitic. It's the idea of the vast, long-standing conspiracy of Jews, which are then particularized in a family like the Rothschilds. And interestingly enough, in the United States, that gets flipped over to the Rockefellers, who obviously aren't Jewish. And so what you have then is this theory which simply waffles back and forth between its anti-Jewish variant and its simply generic anti-elite variant. But my argument and the argument of a number of other analysts is that you simply can't unpackage it at this point, that once you start to invoke this vast conspiracy that goes back, whether it's to the 1800s or the Great Pyramids, and you start to incorporate the Rothschilds and the Schiffs and other Jewish banking names, Jewish-sounding names at least, that's when it simply incorporates at least an insensitivity to historic anti-Semitism, if not what can be arguably called inadvertent or non-intentional anti-Semitism.
So you're saying that his one paragraph here on page 60 where he says, this might be a good point to dismiss claims that the modern secret societies, either wittingly or otherwise, are furthering the aims of an international Jewish conspiracy. There's no evidence of substance to prove that Jews or Hebrews are any more greedy or ambitious than anyone else.
Well, sure, some of my best friends are Jews, right?
Right.
You know, it's
mm-hmm.
the same thing. I don't doubt that he thinks that to be so. But you can independently look at a body of work and say, oh, I recognize that. That's the old Freemason protocol theory. And you can argue then, I think, with some justification that, does this theory lean towards the sort of Birch Society Illuminati version of the conspiracy, and Jim Marr's works does, or does it lean towards the more neo-Nazi version of openly anti-Semitic, which his work does not? But having said that his work leans towards the Birch Society, a right-wing group that hates feminists, hates homosexuals, you know, hates anything progressive, let's be clear that this is a right-wing conspiracy that's been used to destroy leftist movements for hundreds of years. So how dumb do you have to be to put on a progressive radio station a right-wing theory that's used to destroy broad left coalitions? You know, answer that question yourself. But having recognized that he apparently does not think of himself as anti-Semitic, you then look at this material and you say independently, it is still rooted in that historic anti-Semitic theory, and that as long as you overemphasize the role of the Rothschilds and see this as a long-standing conspiracy that links all these groups with the Rothschilds, then you have to say that it is objectively anti-Semitic, even if his intent is not to arrive at that place. That's where the theory arrives.
We're speaking with Chip Berlay. He's a senior analyst at Political Research Associates, a longtime student of the right wing. He's co-author of Right Wing Populism in America, which came out last November from Guilford. And we are speaking about the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. We're also speaking about Jim Marr's book,
Rule by Secrecy, The Hidden History That Connects the Trilateral Commission, the Freemasons, and the Great Pyramids.
And we're going to take your calls. So if you have questions for Chip Berlay about how to interpret these kinds of tracts, this is your big chance. 212-209-2900. That's 212-209-2900.
So, you know, it's funny, Esther. I just noticed when you read that passage, that disclaimer, he points out that modern secret societies are furthering the aims of international Jewish conspiracy. I wonder if that was carefully written. That is, maybe some of these older ones did, but maybe I'm reading too carefully.
Well, let's go ahead and start taking some calls for Chip Berlay. Hi, you're on the air on WBAI.
Whoops,
we lost a caller. Hi, you're on the air on WBAI.
Yes, I read the book by Jim Mars, and I don't disagree with what Chip Brulé is saying, that the what Jim Mars has written is in the right-wing tradition. But I think it would be fair to try and put the book in its totality. You mentioned the pyramids. Chip, are you there?
Yeah.
You mentioned the pyramids and
the Knights Templar.
Right. Now, I don't now, is it true that the Knights Templars and the pyramids would not really be seen as Jewish, right? I mean, that's not, the Knights Templars is in the Catholic tradition, and the pyramids are in Egypt. I don't know. But they wouldn't, they're not in the Jewish tradition, I guess, right? And what he tries to do is, he does try to link up that part of the story with this old anti-Semitic right-wing traditional view on conspiracy theories, and he does do that. But
here's the problem: there is no connection between the Knights Templar and the Great Pyramids. That was a myth that was started within Freemasonry to be able to use rituals involving the pyramids. And you can trace to when it was done. It was done in the late 1700s and early 1800s, and there is historical records of the argument within Freemasonry as to whether or not you want to try and erect this myth back to the pyramids and to the Knights Templar and to the Rosicrucians. And that was called the occult side of the dispute versus a different side of the dispute. So this was simply another, you know, essentially it's a hoax. It's a harmless hoax if you're a Freemason to claim a direct tie back to the Great Pyramids. But there is no connection between the Great Pyramids in Egypt and the Council on Foreign Relations. They're just different.
We want to thank you for your call. Unfortunately, we're going to go ahead and move on because the board is lighting up like crazy here. So we'll move on to one more caller. Hi, you're on the air on WBAI.
Hello. My name is Blossom Nishas, and I'm a long contributor to participate. And BAI.
Blossom, can you turn your radio down? Hearing a little feedback.
I heard the Marjorie Moore program, and I was shocked. I will tell you, I was a producer of WBAI for about 10 years. I've been contributing to the station for about 31 years, and I was absolutely shocked because apparently she's a nice woman, and she puts out the Sunrise program in the morning, mm-hmm. and it's a kind of an attempt at a healing program, you know, trying to sort of resolve some of the difficulties in BAI, generally among people. And I was shocked at her lack of sophistication and lack of perspicacity in not challenging this thing. This is absolutely outrageous, and I think we need to do several programs and several discussions with Marjorie Moore. And there are a couple of other people on the station who have been influenced by the same bug, and I think we need to talk about it.
Well, definitely what we're trying to contribute to the conversation is to have an expert like Chip Brulé on and to offer the critique that we did feel was missing. We hope, you know, we've told Marjorie Moore that we are doing this program. We hope that she'll consider having Chip on her program as well.
Yes. That's a very good suggestion. I was going to suggest that.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Blossom.
Oh, you're welcome. Bye-bye.
Hi, you're on the air on WBAI. Hello? Okay, let's move on. Hi, you're on the air on WBAI.
Oh, yes, thank you. I'm wondering if Mr. Brulé or anybody else is familiar with the work of Nicholas Goodrich Clark. He wrote a book called Secret Aryan Cults and the Air Influence on Nazi Ideology, other books. It seems that there's a trend in BAI towards this kind of new age sort of resuscitation of Madame Blavatsky's theosophy going on.
That's quite profoundly true. It is a new age restatement of the kind of theosophical arguments of Madame Blavatsky's and others that were, in fact, incorporated into Hitler's conspiracy theories.
Can you explain a little bit about theosophy?
I think that would take us rather far afield.
Yeah, okay.
But essentially, that there was a whole group of people around Hitler who adopted some of these theories of secret societies and allegations of control by secret societies that were put forward by one particular figure, Madame Blavatsky, who had a salon, essentially, in Europe. And that there's some very good scholarship, several books, in fact, that look at the role of a kind of occult conspiracy thinking, which intersected with the earlier sort of Catholic and Protestant defense of rule that was in the 1790s period that first developed the anti-Illuminati conspiracy theory, which was later folded in to the protocols.
All right, we'll take another call. Hi, you're on WBAI.
Hi, it's Randy from Woodstock.
Welcome.
I'd like to ask your guest if he's familiar with any of the work by a man named Bill Cooper.
Yes, Bill Cooper actually puts a section of the protocols in his book and then says, but it's really not about Jews, it's about the, that will go away in a second, larger conspiracy theory. And again, he's a person who says, I'm not anti-Semitic because this really isn't about Jews. It's about Zionists and other conspirators. And so what you have here is a kind of combination of the Patriot Right with UFO theories and other right-wing conspiracy theories in a very large book that Cooper wrote. Behold the Pale Horse is the name of that book.
So kind of the same
ilk.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, Jim Mars also writes about UFOs as well. Cooper actually is even more exotic than Jim Mars. He's way, way out there.
All right, we'll take another caller. Hi, you're on the air on WBAI. Hello?
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air.
This is Claire Toyce from Plainview. I'm thrilled you're having this program. I agree with the woman who called once before. I don't want to take up your time. I'm thrilled, and someone should get in contact with Marjorie Moore. I was appalled by her program. Thank you very much for having this program. I'll hang up now.
Well, thanks for the positive feedback. And again, if people want to encourage Marjorie Moore or other hosts on the station to have right-wing experts like Chip Berlay on, we encourage that.
I would prefer experts on the right wing.
All right, you're right. Sorry about that.
That's okay.
Students, long-term experts on the right wing.
It's an occupational hazard.
Hi, you're on the air on WBAI.
Hi, Sandra. Good show. I just want to put out that Eutrice Leeds' father was a Mason, as was mine. And my question to...
my grandfather was a Mason, now that we're coming
so
out.
So was my grandfather on that one side, the half Travis. I'm one quarter Travis, but the rest Jewish. But I'm concerned by the fluid anti-Semitism that seems to float across color, ethnic. I'm fascinated and appalled by it. Could you address that, which fits right in with what you're talking about? Like, I get upset when how convenient Jews are as a scapegoat, and I'll listen off the air.
Well, it definitely is happening, and there's a couple of good books. Actually, there's a number of new books out on the rise of conspiracy thinking around the world, and one of the a shared analysis among many of these authors is the idea that since globalization of the economies of the world on behalf of large corporate interests is in fact happening, and the average person is in fact less able to affect their lives, to have agency, as scholars would say, that this sense of being cut off from any control over your life leads some people to conclude that the only possible explanation is that there's some kind of secret conspiracy against all of us, and that in times of that of kind of economic or social stress, some people adopt this conspiracist mode of thinking, not because they're mentally ill. The old theory was that people who adopted the paranoid style in American politics, as Hofstadter put it, suffered some psychological malady. That turns out not to be true. What it is that people under stress sometimes grab onto scapegoating theories, and a conspiracy theory is just a narrative form of scapegoating. And if you think your life's out of control and the world is, you know, very complicated and you don't feel you have any power in it, then scapegoating and demonization of some other is, in fact, unfortunately, one of the responses that human beings make. And so I think it's important to see a conspiracist theory as a narrative that is scapegoating. It's a story about who's plotting against you, in which the other becomes evil. And because they're so evil, anything you do against them is justified.
We've been speaking with Chip Berlay. He's a senior analyst at Political Research Associates. He is an expert on the radical right. He's co-author of Right-Wing Populism in America. And Chip, we're out of time. Thank you so much for helping to illuminate Jim Marr's book, Rule by Secrecy, and its roots in tracts such as the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. And thanks to all the many callers who called in that we didn't have time to get to. Thanks for your thoughtful comments. Chip, is there a way that people can check out PRA materials online or contact the organization if they want further information?
Well, sure. We have a very extensive webpage, including long discussions of the protocols. Just search for protocols. It's publicEye.org, P-U-B-L-I-C, publicEye.org, publicEye.org. And that's the best way. Or people can call and ask for information at 617-666-5300.
Well, thank you so much, Chip, for joining us. I'm sure we're going to be talking with you again, if not on this, certainly many other subjects.
Well, it's
again.
Not a new issue. I have close to 200 books claiming the secret conspiracy going back to the late 1700s. So don't think of Jim Marr as something new. It's something old that's just been repackaged.
Thanks again. For those of you that are interested in that book I referred to, it's by Norman Cohn. It's called Warrant for Genocide, The Myth of the Jewish World Conspiracy and the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. It's been reissued by Serif, S-E-R-I-F, Press, which is a British publisher, and you can get it from any of the online venues, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and so on.
And again, to reach Chip Berlay's organization on the web, it's publicEye.org. This has been Beyond the Pale, the Progressive Jewish Radio Hour here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. Stay tuned up next for Shelton Walden, Walden's Pond, and after that for Latino Journal. You can reach us at 212-647-8966 through our sponsoring organization, Jews for Racial and Economic Justice, or you can email us at radicaljew@AOL.com. We wanted just to announce a series that's beginning this summer at the Jewish Museum. It begins Tuesday, July 10th, and every Tuesday for July and August, they're going to be showing clips from TV shows and also having live music. This Tuesday, July 10th, the kickoff is music by Cynthia Sayer, who is one of the world's great jazz banjo players, and clips from the Briss episodes of 30-something and Seinfeld. So you might want to check that out. The Jewish Museum is reachable at 212-423-3271. So stay tuned for Shelton Walden up next.
Lowlife Louis Ramos of Jersey or Pro Wrestling. Thanks for listening. Thanks for pledging your support. And please pay your pledge or I'm coming over for dinner. And if you don't pay, I'm staying for breakfast, pal.
Avoid those unexpected drop-ins and sleepovers. Send your check or money order to WBAI, P.O. Box 11445, New York, New York, 10277. That's payable to WBAI, P.O. Box 11445, New York, 10277.